Hello and welcome to DNA Today. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. DNA Today informs on what's happening in the genetic world. My show's packed news stories and lessons, all to keep you updated and educated on the ever-changing world of genetics. And I want to remind you before I forget, I'm still broadcasting through winter break, so tune in Mondays at 1 p.m., every Monday at 1 p.m. I'm going to continue on, and we'll see if second semester I get the same slot. I think I will, but no promises. Today's episode focuses on epigenetics. There was a genetic presentation here at UConn relating to epigenetics, and I thought, hey, why not make the whole show epigenetics related at least? So I'm going to be giving the highlights from that presentation, and I also have a little mini lesson we got and a news story. So it's another packed episode we got going on here. So before I get into going over the UConn presentation and everything else, I should probably start with what epigenetics is. So epigenetics is the study of cellular and different traits that are heritable by daughter cells. And it's not causing changes in the DNA sequence. That's a really important bit, probably the most important bit to understand what epigenetics is. It's not changes in the base sequence, like the base pairs, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. And these are changes that can alter the expression of genes and therefore the production of proteins. And epigenetics describes the study of stable long-term alterations in the transcriptional potential of a cell. So this is talking about, again, the gene expression of cells. There's a fantastic resource I want you guys to know about. You can really learn a lot about epigenetics from it. It's from the University of Utah. There are videos and interactive exercises. I just did a little bit, didn't have a lot of time, but I'm definitely going to look more into it over my vacation here. You can go to learn.genetics.utah.edu/content/epigenetics. And I know you're not going to remember that, so I'll put it on the website, dnapodcast.com. So the UConn presentation I mentioned was by Dr. Brian Chadwick. He's an assistant professor of biological sciences at Florida State University, and he presented his work, and it was titled Exploring the Relationship Between the Higher Order Organization of the Human Inactive X Chromosomes and Gene Silencing. So I'm going to break down what this means, what he talked about, and what we know so far, at least a little bit of what we know so far about inactivation of X chromosomes between different genders. So the X chromosome inactivation is a mammalian form of dosage compensation that serves to balance the levels of X-linked gene expression between the sexes. So this is because males only have one X chromosomes, while females have two. So in order for the amount of gene expression to be equal, there has to be a regulation in the amount of proteins produced from these genes. So if both of the chromosomes produced proteins normally, there was normal amount of gene expression, then females would have double the amount of males. Females would have double the amount of proteins than males from the X chromosome. And early in development, one of the two X chromosomes in females is chosen to become the inactive X chromosome, also known as a bar body. And as the name suggests, the inactive chromosome is inactivated. Therefore, genes are not expressed, again, meaning that proteins are not being produced from this one chromosome. Because, again, females have two X chromosomes. Males only have one because the other sex chromosome is a Y chromosome. So this inactivation occurs in females so that there is not twice as much gene expression compared to males. And the inactivation of one X chromosome in females means there's only one active chromosome in each cell, making it equivalent to males. And this inactivation is faithfully maintained throughout all consecutive somatic cell divisions. So this means if one cell has out of the two X chromosomes, one of them is not being activated and it's inactivated, that means all of the daughter cells from that is going to maintain which one is active and which one is inactive out of the two X chromosomes. And epigenetics is the study of cellular and physiological traits that are heritable by daughter cells, not causing changes in the DNA sequence. I know I've said this before, but like it's really important to understand that you're not changing the base pairs. You're changing what's activated and what's inactivated. And there are 3D physical differences between activated and inactivated X chromosomes. And this is part of Dr. Chadwick's research to explore the cause of these physical differences between the active and inactive chromosomes. And he found that a factor was of the difference is the folding pattern of the chromosomes. And if it's folded a certain way, then certain sequences of DNA is not going to be exposed to be able to be transcribed into proteins, transcribed and then translated into proteins. And he talked a lot about, pretty much his whole presentation was about this certain gene, and it was called DXZ4. And he studied this gene and found that it was a tandem repeat. And a tandem repeat is a repeat of a few bases over and over multiple times in the genome, all next to each other, like in tandem. So you might have like three base pairs that's over and over. It can be quite a few times. And this gene, DXZ4, in females, adopts an alternate chromatin organization in response to X chromosome inactivation. And it's packaged into heterochromatin on the active X chromosome. So heterochromatin in the active X chromosome, but in euchromatin, which is a more lightly packed form of the chromatin and bound by the epigenetic organizer protein, CTFF, on the inactive chromosome. So there's kind of two differences between this. And Dr. Chadwick's hypothesis was that tandem repeats are folding elements of inactivation of the X chromosomes. And he was able to test this in human cells, which is pretty cool because usually you're not really dealing with human cells as much in research. It depends on the experiment. But he's now researching the impact of deleting the gene DXZ4 to see if it causes any changes in the folding of the X chromosome. So the relationship between the two and how that affects if the chromosome is activated or inactivated. Dr. Chadwick's lab is also investigating why it is that some genes are reactive, why others are not. And overall, his lab is really interested in the organization and maintenance of the chromatin on the inactivated human X chromosome. So he was able to come to UConn and present a lot of this, obviously, in way more detail. So I really suggest you guys attend these. There's definitely going to be more next semester, and I will keep you updated. Twitter is the best way, at DNA Podcast, to find out what's going on. I pretty much promote anything at the school that's open to the public for you guys to attend to learn more about genetics, since that's my focus here. All right, news story. So I got one news story for you, and this is talking about epigenetics. That's what we're focusing on this episode. And so this is a pretty cool little experiment. It's different kind of from others. And it's focusing on long-term endurance training and how it alters the epigenetic pattern of a human skeletal muscle. So this is according to new research from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, and it was published in the journal Epigenetics, believe it or not. So researchers were interested in a type of epigenetic change called methylation. And in methylation, a methyl group, which is made up of carbon and hydrogen, is either added to or subtracted from a DNA molecule based on, so it's added and subtracted to the DNA molecule without it affecting the original DNA sequence. This is, if you take away one thing from this episode, is that epigenetics is not focused on changing the base sequence. It's focused on whether these are activated or inactivated. And usually methylation is inactivation. There are exceptions to this rule, but overall, this is kind of the general statement for this. And so bases are the same, and the DNA sequence doesn't change. What does change is these added methyl groups, which parts of the DNA gets expressed into proteins. So here's how the study was conducted. 23 healthy young men and women performed supervised one-leg cycling, and with the untrained leg acting as a control. So one of their legs was working hard, and the other one was just kind of chilling there. And the participants took part in a 45-minute training session conducted four times each week during a three-month period. Performance was measured in both legs before and after the training sessions, and biopsies were taken from the skeletal muscle. And here, there was methylation, and the activity of more than 20,000 genes were measured. In the participants' trained legs, the researchers found strong associations between the change in activity of 4,000 genes and epigenetic methylation. A key finding of the study was that the majority of epigenetic changes occurred in enhancers, which are regulatory regions of the genome that kind of can activate certain parts of the genome. And Professor Carl Johan Sundberg, principal investigator at the Karolinska Institute Department of Physiology and Pharmacology, shared his insight, quote, "We found that endurance training in a coordinated fashion affects thousands of DNA methylation sites and genes associated to improve in muscle function and health." He continued on saying this could be of great importance for the understanding and treatment of many common diseases such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, but also for how we maintain a good muscle function throughout life. Interestingly, we also saw that there were epigenetic differences between male and female skeletal muscles, which may be of importance to develop gender-specific therapies in the future. End quote. And so inactivity is bad for health, and regular physical activity improves the quality of life. We kind of all know this, that, you know, you should be eating healthy and going out and exercising. It's kind of that dual effort going on. And it also helps life expectancy. And the exact mechanisms behind these positive effects have been unclear. We know that this is the case, but why is it the case? That's always the question in science, is why. Professor Sundberg concluded that, quote, "The study indicates that the epigenetics is an important part in skeletal muscle adaptations to endurance training." So there's obviously a correlation between exercising and epigenetics of regulating certain proteins. So interesting to see that kind of dynamic, and interesting to hear that all the research going on in epigenetics, and that we don't really know a lot about epigenetics. And as I'll get into here in this little mini lesson, there's more research coming out, but it's a little bit skewed. So there was a pregnant mouse in a laboratory in Boston, Massachusetts, and it was kept on a near-starvation diet when she was close to giving birth. And a scientist expected her babies were born smaller than usual. So you figure if the mother's not eating properly, then probably the babies aren't going to be as healthy. So that makes sense. When they're raised normally, they later develop diabetes. So that is kind of, if we're looking at it as, you know, we have the parent, the pregnant mouse, and then we have the F1 generation, which is the first batch of babies kind of from the litter from the mother. But this is where it gets interesting. Even though these mice were well-fed, the F1 generation, their own young were also born unusually small and with a higher risk of diabetes. And this is kind of strange because nothing changed genetically and they hadn't suffered any problems in the womb or after they were born. The F1 generation was fine when they're pregnant. In the F2 generation, it's, you know, they're, you know, the grandchildren, if we're looking at it that way from the pregnant mouse at the beginning, also has these negative effects. And this may be due to epigenetics. And this field has radically introduced a mysterious third element into the mix, and the life experience of previous generations is influencing generations to come. Another definition of epigenetics is a change in our genetic activity without changing our genetic code. I've said this over and over, but I can't stress it enough. Parents could suddenly find themselves responsible for passing on not only their poor genes, but also their poor lifestyle. So what you do today could affect your children. Professor Ann Ferguson-Smith is the professor who ran this mouse generational study, and she's a geneticist at the University of Cambridge. And she warned that transgenerational epigenetic experiments are difficult to perform and can be misinterpreted. This was what I was saying before, that we can do these studies, but it's not as clear-cut as we may imagine. She said, quote, "Journals are very excited about this. They want to publish this stuff, but we must be more cautious," end quote. And basically the problem is that researchers, including herself, still don't understand the scientific mechanisms behind epigenetic inheritance, explain exactly how it happens. We can kind of observe that, this is happening, but we don't know how it's happening. So it's very hard to have a conclusion and really pull a lot of information from it and learn from it kind of on a grander scale, because we can see these changes happening, but we don't know what molecularly is happening to cause these changes generationally. That if something happens in a grandparent, it can affect the great-great-grandchildren. Potentially, that's kind of what we're researching. Professor Timothy Bester, a geneticist at Columbia University in New York, added, quote, "It's an extremely fashionable topic right now. It's very easy to get studies on transgenerational epigenetic inheritance published," end quote. He even admitted that all this excitement has lowered critical standards. So if you have a study, it's kind of like, oh, this is so exciting. This is proving our point, whereas maybe they don't have as many kind of standards to go by to make sure they're doing everything they're supposed to be, or, you know, passing certain kind of standard tests and all of that. And among the very few sources of data are long-term medical studies over multiple generations. So one that's often quoted is tracking families following the Dutch famine of 1944. And what this famine revealed was that the starvation in one generation had health repercussions on grandchildren. So if a grandfather, you know, was not eating properly and he was starved, you know, his children would obviously be affected, but their children, so his great-grandchildren, would also be affected, even if during their embryonic development they were eating healthy and fine. These epigenetic changes can follow. That's kind of the evidence that has been indicated. And in more recent news, because that was back in 1944, but in more recent news, Professor Marcus Pembrey, a geneticist at the University College London and the University of Bristol, he spent the last 15 years looking for proof of epigenetic inheritance in people, and he was really mining over the Avon Longitudinal Study, which has monitored 14,000 new mothers and their children since the early 1900s. So this is kind of a huge study that scientists really can take advantage of, because it's been going on for a while now. And Pembrey and his colleagues found that men who have started smoking before they were 11 had sons who were more likely to be obese by the time they were teenagers. Meanwhile, the grandsons of grandmothers who smoked, even if their mothers didn't, were bigger, so that they were more obese as well. So you really can't see this correlation between it. But again, we don't know all of the molecular processes behind this and what really is happening. Psychiatrists have also pinpointed abnormalities that might be explained by epigenetics. Rachel Yuhunda, a psychiatrist and neuroscientist at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, discovered that pregnant survivors of the 9/11 World Trade Center attacks who suffered post-traumatic stress disorder have offspring with lower levels of cortisol. And this is a hormone associated with a heightened state of alarm. Kind of if something happens, your cortisol levels kind of increase because you're ready to fight, kind of that fight or flight response. And her research showed that the same applies to the offspring of Holocaust survivors. So that, again, if something is happening to the parent or grandparent, it can affect the offspring from that, even if it's not directly. That maybe even the children that were born around 9/11 that had embryonic development during 9/11 and their mother had post-traumatic stress disorder, that maybe their children will also be affected. Maybe their cortisol levels will be affected, because it's interesting that epigenetics, it's kind of like passing on memories through your genes, which is really crazy to think about. But I'll get into a little cool thing about this right now. So this is going back to mice, and this was a widely covered study published at the end of last year, and researchers Carrie Russler and Brian Diaz at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, gave male lab mice electric shocks every time they were exposed to the smell, a certain smell. And this is a chemical used in perfumes because of its sweet fragrance, such as like cherries and blossoms. And eventually, the result was that mice shuddered at the mere scent of the smell, because they were used to smelling it and then being shocked, kind of like Pavlov's dogs, you know, like what's coming. You're conditioned this way. So they had all of this, and whenever they'd smell this, they would then get shocked. So if they smelled it, they expected the shock to come. And again, this is what really surprises me, is that their children feared the smell too, even though they hadn't received any shocks. So that kind of ingrained in them that this smell means danger, something's going to happen, and their offspring have the same response even though the offspring didn't have those shocks administered to them after smelling that. So it's kind of like these memories are being passed down through your genes, just like talking about, you know, starvation, PTSD from 9/11, and these can impact the fetus. And I believe, don't quote me on this, but I believe this is true even if the fetus is not, like, say, because these are male mice, right? So the offspring were not currently being, you know, developed embryonically, so, because that would be in the mother. So obviously that the males, something had passed in their sperm that said, okay, like, when you smell this, expect danger. And somehow that memory gets put in your genes and given to your children. So that's what this study is kind of indicating. And it even expands to the grandchildren. The grandchildren of the original mice that had the smell and then shock, the grandchildren also, if they had the smell, they would expect the shock. They got scared. And Pembry said, quote, "It was a beautiful controlled experiment. And the results suggest that the fear of smelling this certain distinct smell passes into the sperm of the mice through some kind of chemical process, leaving epigenetic markers that aren't erased in the womb. And some reporters have linked it to a memory being passed down to generations." So it really is interesting. Hopefully soon we'll be exploring really molecularly what's going on. And kind of like when the Human Genome Project said that they had the first draft of the human genome done, that was a huge mark. That was a huge step in saying that, wow, how is this going to change things down the road of really having this information? Are we going to be able to have more personalized medicine, which I refer to a lot? How is this going to change diagnosing diseases and all of this stuff? And obviously, we've come a long way from that. And now this is kind of like the next thing, is epigenetics. As I've said, it's a hot topic right now, and seeing what we can learn from epigenetics, because that's kind of the missing piece. We have the base pairs. All right, we know this. We can sequence genomes fairly easily now compared to 10, 20 years ago. But now, if we can figure out more about epigenetics, then we can figure out kind of how more inheritance and how things are passed along, and maybe even regulating genes, because a lot of what epigenetics is regulating genes, not by the sequence of base pairs, but by activating and inactivating certain base sequences, certain DNA sequences. So how that kind of works would be great to figure out, because that would just enhance personalized medicine, really figure out even gene therapy, which I've talked about on the show before, that gene therapy is when you can kind of maybe insert or somehow regulate a gene that is causing a genetic disorder. And that can happen through DNA sequences and actually, you know, inserting or knocking out a gene. And I've talked about before the knocking out gene, the Nobel Prize winner for that experiment and studies and research presented at the opening of Jackson Laboratories a couple months ago. And so these are things that can happen. And learning about epigenetics can really expand our knowledge in genetics and understand, again, these genetic disorders, because this is so important. If we can really figure out what's going on in within genetics and all of that, we can really then figure out how to treat it and how to make this better. So the question comes down to how long epigenetics effects that these might last. We're talking about generations here. And 100 years ago, our ancestors, what they did, does that matter today? Is that affecting us today? Or is it only a few generations? There's so many questions, more questions than we have answers at this point. But hey, it's science. It happens all the time. And early findings hint that it may wear off within two generations, which would suggest that the human evolution is not much affected by epigenetics, and that maybe it's more of just actually the DNA sequencing and mutations through that. I think usually when we study evolution, we're looking at DNA sequences and differences in DNA sequences. If you take two species that have diverged, that they came from a common ancestor, and looking at the differences between them, usually we're sequencing their DNA and looking for base pair differences and identifying how many of those exist and saying, all right, if there's X amount, then, you know, they're this percentage the same, this percentage different. And so that's how we can compare those. But now if we can look at epigenetics, that's a whole nother layer of what things are happening, because two animals, two species could have the same, same stretch of DNA base pairs and a DNA sequence. But if in one species, some of those genes are never turned on, then they don't end up phenotypically and, you know, physically being the same or different. Because if those proteins aren't produced the same in both species, they're not going to look the same. So epigenetics really has so much potential. And I kind of see it as similar to the microbiome, of being really kind of the next big genetic related field, that, you know, we have our drafts of the human genome. And this is kind of maybe where the future is going, and really focusing on this. And it's kind of been, epigenetics has kind of been blowing up in the world of genetics. And there's only a slight possibility that, again, the grandchildren are affected. And there isn't any evidence in generations beyond that. So it'd be interesting to see if there is evidence to kind of disprove this statement and see what's going on there. But that's about all I have for epigenetics today. I appreciate you guys tuning in, especially how winter break has started. And again, I will be broadcasting throughout winter break, and I will keep you updated on my slot for next semester. And tune in next week, Monday at 1 p.m. on WHUS.org or 91.7 FM to learn more about genetics. Not sure what I'll be talking about next week, so surprise. DNApodcast.com is full of content, including all episodes broadcasted, and I mean all episodes. There's also mini lessons on there that I've done before I started here at WHUS. And lots of resources that I put on there to expand your genetic knowledge. And I think one of the best resources is what I mentioned before, which would be from the University of Utah, I believe. University of Utah. And their learn.genetics.utah.edu. And there are so many cool resources on there. I'm kind of on there all the time because there's really cool stuff to learn from there. So definitely suggest going there, as well as my own website. Again, that's dnapodcast.com. If you're interested and you want to keep up with kind of what's happening in the world of genetics at UConn, and in general, sometimes I post some other stuff if I'm feeling lucky. You can follow on Twitter at DNA Podcast. You can follow me on Twitter if you're interested at Kira Dineen, KiraDineen. And if you have any questions, please shoot me an email. I love getting emails. I kind of get really excited, and I love hearing from you guys. And if you have suggestions on what you would like me to talk about, please let me know. If you're taking a genetics class and you're like, hey, we started talking about this, but the professor moved on too quickly and I want to learn more, I'll do the homework for you and present it on air live. So that's info@dnapodcast.com. Again, that's info@dnapodcast.com. Again, I'm still broadcasting through winter break, so continue listening. Monday at 1 p.m. All right, thanks for listening, and join me next week again, Monday, 1 p.m., to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.